November 24th, 1980, Long Beach, California. Donald Utter, interviewed by Kay Beagle. You were talking about Democratic clubs that you belong to.
Yes, I was in a number of Democratic clubs. They're kind of ephemeral outfits. They sort of rise when there's an interesting campaign or an interesting candidate or issue. And you always have a small core of faithful few who keep the thing alive. And when the excitement of the campaign is over, why, they just sort of dwindle and diminish. Actually, the Long Beach history is about like that of the CDC activity statewide. It's just sort of gone into a state of decline, and I would guess that their active membership may be one-tenth of what it was at the height of their activity. But the local groups had some effectiveness, and you know, the usual thing, you get out a few precinct workers and campaign headquarter workers, raise some funds, provide an occasional forum for a political speaker, publicity, the usual stuff.
Were there any particular candidates that rallied the troops more than others?
I'm trying to think. I remember, of course, we were heavily involved in the McCarthy campaign when he was president of the race. We were heavily involved in the Governor campaign, and in local races, Art Gottlieb's congressional race took our attention. We worked couple of occasions for several elections for Fred Schell. He ran for Assemblyman from that district.
So did Art Gottlieb
run against Hosmer, or? Gottlieb must have run against Hosmer, yes. And Hosmer was absolutely unbeatable. He had a, in addition to a loyal constituency and plenty of financial backing, he has an extremely efficient office, and his contacts and citizens' constituents are very good. He ran a very efficient operation. I remember one occasion during the Vietnam War when he came out with some ridiculous comments, was published in the Press Telegram about dropping aces of spades to hex the troops of the North Vietnamese. I made some rude remarks in a letter. I knew he was on the West Coast because he was just being quoted by a Long Beach Press Telegram, so I sent the letter to his Long Beach office. Within about 2 days, I had a reply from his Washington office. And then within the week, I went to a fundraising party for a private school in Greece that was being sponsored by a Greek automobile dealer here, and we just sort of went to the social evening. It was over on Phil Hill, and we thought it might be a good bash, so we went to this charity function, and there was Craig Hosmer. So I bearded him. I said, how about that? I said, I just got a letter back from Washington with your signature on it, and here you are. I said, you can't possibly have been there. He said, oh, he says, wait a minute. He said, your name's Utter, isn't it? I had talked to him before, and I said, yes. So he went through all of the particulars of my letter and his response. He was absolutely on top of it. So I asked him how he did it. He said, well, we've got to tell it. He said, you know, the West, isn't it? Long Beach and Washington, but this was the efficiency of this guy's communication with his constituents. And I was, you know, I wasn't patting him on the back. I was being harshly critical. And he came back with a, you know, a reasoned response. The guy was bright as hell, very talented man. evidently he's owned by the wrong people, the nuclear type. I can't think of any other particular candidates off the top of my head, but we worked for many of them. Well, I was involved in the Westside Democratic Club, which in later years has become the East-West Democratic Club, and also the Tom Paine Democratic Club, which has now joined the remnants of it as the East-West Democratic Club. But there's a very weak club organization in Long Beach at the moment. Well, it was one of the more active Democratic clubs, and we had several friends who were active in that club, and we had joint activities with some of the Eastside clubs and the Westside clubs. So we got invited to some of their functions and meetings, and when they had speakers and presentations, we would often go. And we were good friends of the Cougars, who were kind of the core of that Westside club.
And what was the Tom Paine Democratic Club? That sounds like
far to the left. The Tom Paine Democratic Club was the Eastside club, and it was not very far left. It was a fairly conventional group. It was liberal, anti-war. And most of their most active members are now in the East-West Democratic Club. Both of these clubs were liberal clubs. The conservative club in the area was the Lakeland Democratic Club. That was always conservative Democratic Club.
What did they do between elections?
They would try to find an excuse to have a meeting, hopefully every month, and often it wasn't that often, and the meetings were often kind of pathetic. They would come together and wring hands about where all the people, and didn't really accomplish much. They were a disappointment to me in that in many cases they avoided local issues because they thought this would be somewhat divisive. They wanted to keep their troops unattended for the great national crusades. And I think that this was a mistake that these organizations made, because it's the local issues that really generate usually the most emotion. And these are the issues that tend to cut across party lines, but they give you the opportunity to recruit people and keep active and be involved in something that matters. You're dealing with issues instead of just mounds of words.
How early did you belong to the Democratic Club?
Well, the first Democratic Club I belonged to was the Young Democrats of Long Beach. And I remember I was treasurer at age 18. I wasn't old enough to vote, and this was before they, you know, had to be 21 years old to vote. But I looked like a responsible type, and I was a warm body, so they gave me an office. And this group was a small group, mostly college students, but a few young professionals. And we functioned in assembly and congressional races, and, some small amount of low-grade troop power.
So that they have been
Yes, there have been many of them. I have belonged to a good many. Alameda Bay, Coast Independent Democratic Club are two that are now defunct, but I was an officer of one type or another.
Well,
the Alameda Spay Club was quite a going organization for a number of years. I became program chairman of that group. I took over the program chairmanship from Larry Allison, who is currently editor of Press Telegram, when he received some sort of a promotion from reporter to something else. And so I ended up as program chairman. And we had a community-centered program and concerned ourselves with all sorts of local issues, area-wide issues, but not necessarily, all national issues. And I was president of the outfit when the freeway fight over the Crosstown Freeway appeared, and our club took a position opposing the freeway, and I worked with John Hall on opposing that Crosstown Freeway. But the Democratic Club movement is just a shadow of the good old CDC days, and I don't see any prospect of any real revival. I know the Republicans have an extremely strong organization in town, but except for the Republican Women's Organization, I just don't hear much about their activities. Incidentally, the most consistent and the most potent Democratic club in Long Beach is the Democratic Women's Study Club. Ruth and I both belong to that. There are a number of men that belong. And that's a going outfit. Now, we don't attend very many meetings, but we get involved in their activities, and we get to buy tickets for their fundraisers at the community theater and do our small good works. But that club is very effective. They actually raise a good deal of money for candidates, considering that most of their membership is women past 60, most of whom live on very modest incomes. It's amazing that they're able to generate cash.
Did they actually study something?
Well, they're involved in issues all the time, local issues as well as party questions. I was invited to speak to that group once about community organization and citizens groups in terms of influencing local policy. This was a number of years ago, and I spoke to them on the question of the Ohio oil terminal as well. They were very interested in that. They took a vote as an organization opposing the Ohio terminal at a time when conventional wisdom was that this is progress, and most organizations were supporting it.
When was
the
Ohio terminal
CDC strong? Oof. Fred Kugler has the history all written down.
Yeah.
And his records are better than my memory.
Okay.
I simply don't have dates. I would guess.
Well, could you identify it with some president?
That this would be probably in the just post-World War II era was when it really got going, because I can remember when Alan Crampton was the big honcho in CDC. And prior to that, he had been very active in the United World Federalists. And one of the attractions of the CDC for us was their peace position. And they were unusual for a political group to take a forward position on a peace issue, which was considered, politically risky to stick your neck out on that one. But the CDC was compromised, as all political groups tend to become, because you make commitments to this person and that person, and pretty soon you're committed all over the map, and your eager followers run out of gas. People can only keep their excitement up about so long, and then they're off to something else.
So
The reorganization essentially in California, the Democratic Party leading to the election of first Governor Brown. Yes, and they were involved with assisting Brown early on. I don't think that CDC as an organization was that gung-ho about Pat Brown. I mean, a lot of the CDC leadership. But they saw him as, you always love a winner in your party, even if he isn't quite the right strike that you would prefer.
Yeah, they preferred him to win the yellow one, perhaps.
Yes, yeah, considerably. Speaking of California politics, it is interesting that in recent years we've seen the schisms in the Democratic Party, and there's been some hand-wringing among the Democrats. Why can't they win elections with the registration that they have? They deal heavier than the Republican registration. But the Republicans have had terrible feuds in California. I mean, the Nolan fight, Shell, who ran for the Republican nomination for governor, the arch conservative, had the John Birch Society support. And when Shell lost in the primary, was that for Nolan? The conservative Republicans just sat on their hands in the next election, and that was responsible for electing a Democratic governor. I think it was Brown in his first race. But the conservative Republicans just went on strike when they lost their darling. This Long Beach area has always been a kind of a conservative area, and there have been times when they elected liberal legislators, but these people were always elected by narrow margins, and their tenure was always precarious. They were never locked in. I mean, we did have one. Clyde Doyle, when he was the representative from this district, could have been elected for life, and he was a liberal, but he's the only one. And of course, when the redistricting took place too many years ago, and the growth in Los Angeles County had been so large that they made a lot of new congressional districts, it was advantageous for him to take a district to the north of this, and he ran in that district for a couple of terms before he died.
What about
Senate?
Wasn't he a liberal?
Kinnick was a liberal, yes. And, but he was accepted by the establishment. He had the same kind of across-the-spectrum appeal that Clyde Doyle had. Kinnick, of course, had come out of the Long Beach Police Department. He'd been a juvenile officer in Long Beach, and I guess ran the juvenile bureau before he went into the assembly. And he was a kind of a law and order figure type, although he was a liberally oriented person and was very much concerned with social welfare concerns, and informed about them because that had been his business. But Kinnock's record in the legislature actually was very good. I mean, he had a very solid liberal record, and yet he did not frighten the conservative establishment in Long Beach. But the contrast between a Kinnock and a Sparrow is just fantastic. I mean, Sparrow is, you know, about 10 miles to the right of Kinnock on every issue.
Well, how is it that they come to represent the same people?
Well, in the case of Sparrow, of course, he followed Dick Majan, who left office early to assume the state attorney general's office. And Sparrow was elected in a special election where the Republicans were determined to preserve the seat. So Sparrow had plenty of backing. He also has plenty of money of his own. And so they just went in and nailed down the seat. The Democrats were not prepared to spend that much money for what looked like what would be for them a marginal seat after Dick Majan had been in the seat for a while. Dick Majan was very popular as a state senator. He's a very personable man. And not too frightening to many people, but unfortunately he is owned by the Republican establishment who created him. They brought him to Long Beach, established his little law office on 2nd Street. He went through the standard exposure name development campaign of being involved in every kind of civic organization, you know, like the Cancer Crusade and the United Way and la-di-da, the various clubs, Chamber of Commerce, Belmont Shore Business Association, all of these things which give name exposure. And then he was financed to run for the Assembly, and a couple of terms in the Assembly, and then the State Senate, and now he's Attorney General, and this same group who had been supporting him would really like to run him for governor. Of course, he's a perennial candidate for governor. He doesn't actually run, but I mean, in the early selection process, his name is always one of those which he's mentioned, and it's not accidental because that's what he's going for.
Yeah, I wonder what makes somebody, what you say is frightening to too many people. I mean, I find Dick Majan extremely frightening. It seems to me that he wants to build his career on the misfortunes of other people and the really backward view of where California should be going.
Well, I've talked to him a number of times, and on a face-to-face basis, he's a very straightforward, very soft-spoken, gentle type. I know that that he comes out, you know, in many campaigns recently, for instance, his intervention against Yvonne Burke in the supervisorial race here in Los Angeles County. I mean, even he came out slashing. He's quite capable of this, but on a constituent contact basis, he's very thoughtful and gracious. I've talked to him about a number of issues. The last time I talked to him, I ran into him in a bookstore up on 2nd Street. And I had one issue that was important to me, and I threw it at him, and he said, well, he was interested because he's a Long Beach resident, but this was a local issue, and he simply hadn't had any need as a state officer to look at the fine detail. So he begged off taking a position on this particular issue. I forget now what the issue was, but he's a typical pragmatic conservative. He's not a guy who's ever going to be shot down for his principles. He's always going to do what it takes to win an election, as do many liberals, as do most successful politicians. I mean, he's pretty flexible. I think that Reagan is the type of politician, since I don't think he's really that doctrinaire. It's just like professional sports. The name of the game is to win.
Yeah, I guess the thing about, I shouldn't be interviewing myself, the thing about Tim Kaine that bothers me is he's built his campaign on the idea of capital punishment, you can go to jail, things, issues of this sort that don't really deal with, don't really help anybody, take advantage of poor people, don't really just do anything to try to do anything positive about stopping crime or getting people jobs or dealing with the real issues that the future of California depends on.
Yes, but this is a standard political stance by people of the left and the right both. They're always campaigning against straw men and they use issues which have emotional appeal to the constituents. The gun control thing and capital punishment in California are extremely emotional issues, and they have large one-issue constituencies. And you win or lose this constituency on the basis of a stand on this one issue. And this one issue may not be the most important thing in the spectrum. For instance, a liberal Democrat that I know who ran for Congress in Santa Barbara came out in favor of gun control. He was running against Lago Martino, who's the darling of the conservatives up there, and, you know, represents, you know, Bank of America money, and he's unbeatable, really. But Danny Fissin was giving it a good old college try, and I talked to him on the gun control issue. He said, you know, I said, I hate to do this. He says, but I feel I absolutely have to. He says, the northern sort of rural part of that constituency, which goes up to Lompoc and San Luis Obispo, he says, that's all redneck country. And if you come out in favor of gun control, you're dead. I don't care what party you are. I don't care what else you have to offer that area. The gun owners are highly organized up there, and they'll defeat any candidate who comes out against that. He says, so if I'm going to ever get in office, he says, I have to swallow this one. It's a bad issue, and I have to give credit for the political courage of any candidate who can maintain a posture in favor of gun control, because it's hard to do. You take a lot of flack from some real idiots.
Okay, I guess maybe you can change it a little bit. You said you taught at the Mill for 13 years?
Yes.
That just as you were ready to teach science theory, something happened. Why did they move
you? Well, they had developed a policy in Long Beach a couple of years previously of rotating teachers through the inner city schools. The reason for this policy was that they were getting, well, first of all, there were a lot of teachers who were taught in the inner city schools for good many years who had battle fatigue and needed out. But the replacements for these teachers were almost always first-year teachers right out of teacher training schools. And the inner city schools are a tough teaching situation. They're demanding for the teacher. They're more difficult from a pedagogical point of view, because you have this extreme of average and above average students in a classroom with people who have serious educational deficiencies, and many of them have extremely poor attitudes toward education. They're hostile to the school. It's a difficult teaching situation, but at any rate,
somebody picked my name out of a hat. I had been in this one school for 13 years, and, you know, somebody said, well, let this guy have his turn. And at that time, the unwritten rule was that if you were transferred like that to an inner-city school, why, you'd stay 3 years, and then you could request the transfer out. So I figured I'd take my 3 years in the barrel. It was a very educational experience. I went from a middle class, lower middle class area, which where the aspirations of the parents for their kids were generally fairly high. The school was generally popular with the kids. There was a lot of school spirit. It was a good school, an easy school to teach in. We had good administration there, and much of the faculty had been there since the school opened, as I had, and so it had this sort of continuity of tradition. I went from there to Washington Junior High, which was a school in transition. It had been the downtown junior high school in Long Beach, but the downtown area was deteriorating, and the better students tended to come from the Wrigley District, but the Wrigley District was in a period of very rapid change then, so that many of the, certainly the upper middle class families, were moving out of there because the neighborhood was deteriorating. So you found your distribution of students tended to be pushed more and more towards non-achievers, and there was a heavy minority population there, which produced many conflicts. There was a large black population and Chicano population, and these two groups had their disagreements. So it was some of the more critical times in the history of the school while I was there. We had the police helicopters out and the patrol cars and everything else when there was a threat of a riot between the blacks and the Chicanos. It was pretty scary because these conflicts could very, very quickly, within minutes, spread right out into the community. And the black students of the school would call their friends and older brothers and gang members from the Long Beach inner city, and the Chicano groups used the Chicano gangs from the Wilmington area as their supporters. But the thought of adult gangs, these are not kids, I mean gangs, I mean they were people in their late teens and 20s.
Where is Washington Junior High?
Washington Junior High is downtown west side about Pacific Avenue and 14th. 14th and 15th, if I remember. It was a shattering experience to me because I was always been a subject matter oriented teacher. I felt that with my first job was to teach facts to students. That's considered pretty reprehensible by some social crusaders, except that you should be primary role of a teacher is social work. I was not primarily a social worker, but I was a subject matter teacher. I thought that some understanding of science is essential for any citizen, and anybody whoever aspired to a technical job really needed to develop some sort of a strong interest in science fairly early on, because the nature of the preparation for science-oriented jobs is that you have to start fairly early in the
pursuit of the technical end of it. It isn't something you can't decide to be a physicist when you're 25 if you have a degree in English, unless you are really a genius. It's extremely difficult to do. So, I have used the same state textbooks and the same course of study for the city of Long Beach for a good many years at DeMille, and was able to make a pretty good measure of understanding of my students and the progress through the course of study in eighth grade science. And when I went down to Washington, I took a lot of the materials that I had prepared. Now, these were based on the state text and the Long Beach course of study. And in theory, this is what I was supposed to teach. You know, in any school in the district, there is this sweet romance that the course of study is the same in all schools in town. This is simply not true. But my experience there was that the first quarter, I tried to use the same pace that I had used in order to get through the course of study, with using the same textbook. On the basis of the tests and my own gut feelings, agreed with it. The students covered about half of the material at Washington that they were able to cover at DeMille, but their comprehension of the material that they covered was only about half. So making it kind of a rough, not statistically very useful evaluation perhaps, but still it was useful to me. I was able to feel that at Washington, working harder than I had ever worked in a teaching job, my students were learning about 25% as much as they were at DeMille. That was shattering to me. That made me decide that I was certainly the wrong person for that job, because the kind of orientation I had didn't work. I discovered that the level of achievement in other subject areas was pretty much the same, and that it wasn't me, but it was the atmosphere of the school. It was a non-achieving school, and that spirit really kind of pervaded it. I really felt sorry for the handful of good students we had there. Some of them were very, very bright, gifted kids, and whatever education they got, they had to sort of get on their own, because there wasn't much way they could get it in the regular classroom situation, because you ended up directing your classroom work toward the middle of the class, or perhaps even slightly below the middle. Because in that school environment, where you had so many control problems, control was more important than teaching. And if you could keep the lid on and no fights and don't tear the place apart, why, that was considered successful, and nobody was going to look down on you if kids weren't learning very much in your class, because they weren't learning very much in any class. But my 3 years there were very, very frustrating, and convinced me that difficult schools require very special kind of programs and a much, much higher teacher-to-pupil ratio than other areas. The Long Beach District made some allowance for that, but not near enough to really do the job. But the parents who were being told by the school district that all of our schools are good and that you get the same program at one junior high as another, or one elementary school as another, or one high school as another, these parents are simply being lied to. That is just absolutely not true. And if parents
we have the phenomenon of white flight, which is considered a, you know, kind of an antisocial move. But parents who love their children can certainly be excused for trying to put them in the best schools they can, because there is a tremendous difference between schools within the same district. I wish I had the answer to how to turn it around, but any of the answers require a lot of money, and in this time of contracting budgets, I see the situation is pretty grim and dismal for a long time to come.
Can
you hear this? Yes.
And?
And I requested a transfer out, and fortunately, an old friend of mine, Ross Watlett, who was then principal of Marshall Junior High, happened to see my name on a 3x5 file card that was tossed on a table at a principal's meeting of teachers who were seeking transfers, and he picked it up and he said, "I'll take this one," and so I ended up at his school. This is the way it's done. And Ross had been a vice principal many years before at DeMille Junior High, and I'd worked with him. And he was now principal of Marshall. So he picked my name out of a hat, and I went to Marshall for the last 4 years of my teaching.
What was Marshall's constituency like?
Marshall's constituency was about like DeMille's. It was mostly lower middle class with a sprinkling of upper middle class. Marshall had quite a few students from El Dorado, and this was a more affluent area. And there's a very, very high correlation between the achievement of students and the income level of the community. It's about the best correlation that you can have with achievement. But at any rate, it was a good school, good staff, good morale, and really a soft touch after Washington. And once again, back in a situation where I had a good deal more job satisfaction, I could feel I was really teaching kids and learning something. And, you know, everybody's got a little freeloader in him, but it is more fun to work in a job when you really feel like you're earning your pay. I got a thrill while I was out at Marshall. I went in for a routine physical examination one Christmas vacation to please my wife, who thought that everybody ought to have a physical every year. I thought it was nonsense. I felt fine. But as a consequence of the physical, I turned up with a nice, well-diagnosed prostatic cancer. And that attenuates one's attention. And I suddenly began to realize, once you've had a cancer diagnosis, you suddenly realize that you are not immortal. And you begin to decide what you want to do with your time. And this was the thing that motivated me to take an early retirement. And about a year and a half after I had my cancer diagnosis, I retired at 57, which was considered a bit young, but in my situation, I wasn't a bit too sure that, you know, I was going to be around forever, so I wanted to have a couple of years to myself. So I left the public payroll, and now I do good works for nothing.
Well, I'm not
to
help the rest of
them. Yes, for no pay.
Well, okay, we were talking about toxic problems. And maybe we
What do you know about the oil that came out from under the ground in Long Beach as a key? Do you think about that as a geologist as well as a concerned citizen?